Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality, continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we'll be looking at diabetic retinopathy. More than 4 million people in the UK have some form of diabetes, and that number is rising. Diabetes is a chronic condition, and it can be difficult to manage, but ensuring that blood sugar levels are well controlled is essential. High blood sugar over time can damage the retina, and that's because the retina needs a constant supply of blood, but high blood sugar damages these vessels and can eventually cause bleeding or scar tissue inside the eye. Many people with diabetes develop some form of diabetic eye disease, and the World Health Organization has estimated that diabetic retinopathy is responsible for 37 million cases of blindness around the world, almost 5% of cases. And that's why annual screening for all patients with diabetes is essential, to detect changes in the eye early on and before they threaten sight. In this episode, we'll explore the next frontier of eye screening, the role that AI technology can potentially play, and we'll also look further down the care pathway so you can provide the best possible support for your patients. First though, Jason Hoskin, who has diabetes and is also the show's producer, will take us into his eye screening appointment at St Thomas's Hospital in London.
Jason Hoskin.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
Hi, thank you.
Take a seat on this show.
I'm Cameron Rajabi. I'm one of the senior retinal screener graders, and I've been doing this for about 7 years.
I'm going to give you some eye drops. We put the eye drops in because it gives us a clearer image of the retina.
Yeah.
It's going to take about 20 minutes for the dilation to work. Once your dilation.
So you've done my eye drops.
I've done your eye drops. You've waited 20 minutes, and put your chin on the chin rest. And your forehead touching the bar. So, you're gonna see a flashing green light.
Yeah.
I want you to follow that green light to the left. You'll see it moving. Look straight ahead, that's it. That's your first picture. Ah, there's a blink there.
I might blink.
You blinked, but I'm gonna take it again, don't worry. You just follow the light to the left and I'll just do it again. That one's kind of there. Bit of eyelid. So, now let me show you the pictures. That's done. You can sit back and relax.
Okay.
And I will keep four images. Two maculars, two nasal views. We are looking for retinopathy or maculopathy. We're looking at these vessels. We're checking to see if there's any abnormalities.
Yeah.
If there are any exudates or any sort of leaking or any kind of hemorrhaging. And what we normally do is we analyze it and compare it with last time, and we check to see if there's any changes.
Sure. So last time I had a bit of background retinopathy.
That's right. It's your left eye, and there's a tiny little microaneurysm just here. Can you see it?
Oh yeah.
So what we would do is we'll check to see if that has changed in size, or sometimes they do disappear over time if you're controlling your sugar levels.
Mm.
So this is what we call a kind of low risk, very, very mild retinopathy.
So the checking is all done by you? It's all kind of manual? There's no technology that helps with that?
So it's all done by human beings, for now. We have different levels of grading. For example, in primary, I would look at yours and I'll put microaneurysm in your left eye. Then that would go to secondary and it will get checked again, make sure the primary grader's not accidentally done it or mistakenly seen something. If the secondary says yes, there is a microaneurysm in the left eye, it'll get any recalled because they've agreed, right? And it's mild retinopathy. If the secondary says no, there isn't a microaneurysm, it'll go to arbitration, which is the third check. Another third person will have a look and see, is there a microaneurysm? If arbitration see anything abnormal or anything which is non-diabetic or anything which primary and secondary have missed, then it will go to referable outcome, which is another level. So can you see how many levels of checks we have before it reaches the hospital?
So I guess now you go through that step-by-step process. When will I get my results as a patient?
Yes, so you normally get the results between 2 to 3 weeks. Your GP will get a copy, and of course you'll get a copy sent to your house. What we'll do is analyze those images properly. Your images might go through those four stages. If there is anything which your GP needs to know, we will make a comment.
Well, how bad would it have to be referred to ophthalmology?
Well, we have different outcomes. So in your case, your R1M0, which is a annual recall. Then another outcome is R1M1, which is where you have a bit of maculopathy. Any sort of maculopathy, we would want to see you in the OCT clinic, which is in-house. We normally invite you in 1 month, and once you've done your OCT scan, we will either invite you in 6 months or 12 months according to what we see and how high risk you are. But we'll keep you in-house unless we find something referable where we can refer you to the hospital. Then another grade is R2, which is like IRMAs, multiple blots, kind of more moderate retinopathy rather than low risk. And then we have R3A, which is active retinopathy. We've got new vessels, we've got vitreous hemorrhages. Those are urgent referrals to the hospital and you need to have treatment for DR. But also we've got non-DR routes as well, where if we do see something dodgy which is not related to diabetes, we still refer. We've got same day referral pathways for detachments and anything which we find which is like papilledema. So yeah.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to Cam Rajabi. Cam is also one of the organisers of the BARS, the British Association of Retinal Screening. And this September, their annual conference is in Bristol, which will be a great opportunity for optometrists that are interested to learn more from a range of experts about diabetic retinopathy. So that's how the grading systems tend to work in England's diabetic eye screening services. But what about the next frontier in technology? How does artificial intelligence promise to change this process?
AI technology can help the patient, because this anxiety about complications is something that people live with every day.
Kathy Egan is a consultant ophthalmologist and the clinical lead for the Diabetic Retinopathy Service at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. And she's looking at AI approaches in the diagnosis of diabetic retinopathy.
So if you were able to turn up to your diabetic eye screening appointment and instead of waiting weeks or months for the answer about, will I go blind, the AI technology potentially could give you that answer within seconds of having the photograph taken. So from the patient perspective, I think it's fantastic. From a clinician point of view, we all make mistakes. Looking for subtle things like microaneurysms, it's pretty well known that ophthalmologists who are interested in things that they can treat are pretty bad at finding that single microaneurysm compared with either the AI technology or professional graders who do a lot better at that task than we do. So I think for a clinician, that decision support's important. For health service, for the NHS, introducing these technologies could potentially save time.
And presumably, it's not just time spent on patient management. There's benefit for research.
Yeah, some of the research studies we're doing at the moment, looking at 100,000 image sets, can do that work within the course of a week. That takes a single screening program a year to do with a team of professional graders. So that would free up people so you could use your human graders more effectively to look for other pathology on the images. You could put your time into counselling the patients about the disease that's there, what happens next, for example, when you find disease. You could put the time into taking more of the photographs. That still has not been automated.
Okay, and how does the AI technology work in diabetic screening?
Machine learning, AI, it's all about image analysis. So in the context of diabetic retinopathy, the first step is work out if the image in front of you is gradable or not. We're all aware of images that might be affected by cataract or vitreous hemorrhage, etc. Second step is to take the retinal image, work out what's normal. So the algorithm would find the optic nerve, find the normal retinal vessels, and determine what is a normal background retina. Against that background, there'll be, for example, a microaneurysm, which will be a cluster of pixels, which will have a different appearance from the rest of the background retina. The algorithm will then assign that cluster of pixels a probability of truly being a microaneurysm.
So I can see how the technology would be good at differentiating between something that is there or not there. But what about recognising different types of lesions or abnormal retinal changes?
The algorithms have now developed a bit further so they can find the other lesions of diabetic retinopathy, like hemorrhages, cotton wool spots, exudates, etc. Less good traditionally at finding new vessels. That was a task that humans were better at for a long time. But the algorithms more recently are becoming better at diagnosing the high grades of severity of diabetic retinopathy.
So if the AI detects that the image is positive for disease, does that image then go onto a human grader?
Well, that depends on the pathway that you determine and the thresholds that you set the algorithm at for referral. So at the very simplest level, yes, and the proposal in the NHS program would be to introduce the technology at exactly that level, similar to what a level one primary grader would do, disease, no disease. If there is disease present, it would go on to a secondary level grader or a tertiary level grader to determine the next steps, potentially referral to the hospitalised service.
So you'd think that people would be more accepting of the AI technology because it's on par with what we're doing already, but faster and more sensitive.
Yeah, I think the NHS is very enthusiastic about introduction of this kind of technology into the pathway. The NHS is a little bit like a super tanker. So once it changes direction, it kind of stays in that direction for a long time. So my research group's been working like the tugboats for quite a long time to kind of nudge the super tanker in the direction of implementing what I think is hugely valuable technology into the NHS screening pathway, but it needs to be done safely and that it's equitable as well.
That's a really good point, because there has been quite a lot of reporting in the media about potential AI bias, especially when it comes to gender and ethnicity. So would this apply to the AI used in diabetic retinopathy screening? In other words, will these algorithms work for everyone?
A lot of these algorithms were developed in wealthy, not particularly ethnically diverse populations. And so the retinal images that we use to train the algorithm may come from groups that are not similar to the population in which you wish to deploy them. And so you absolutely require evidence that it will work for the younger age groups in the population, that it will work for the elderly, that it will work for both males and females, that it will work for all of the various ethnic groups that you have within the population you choose to deploy it in. And that work is taken very seriously by the NHS. There are grants underway at the moment to assure the public and clinicians that the algorithms will be safe and effective for all groups in the population.
Is there anything that you think that the AI would struggle to detect with diabetic eye disease?
Yeah, algorithms find that 50% of images that are graded by the algorithm as disease positive, when referred to a human grader, may have no disease or may have no referable disease. So if you took 100 images that a human grader said were disease negative, they would stay within the annual once-a-year diabetic eye screening program in the community. If you now take those same images, put them through an algorithm that says 50% of them are disease positive, and then those patients are then referred to the hospital eye service, that creates a lot of anxiety for the patient. It creates a lot of capacity problems for the NHS. So that's going to be one of the challenges, I think, for the technology.
How far away are we from having these systems being used?
Well, an algorithm called iGrading M has been part of the national program in Scotland for more than a decade now and is introduced at that disease, no disease step routinely in most of the programs in Scotland, as I understand. In Europe, there are more than a dozen technologies which are already CE marked, which means that they're licensed for use. So any of us could buy them and introduce them into practice.
So what's the next step for the rest of the UK?
For England, Wales and Northern Ireland, they'll be following along the National Screening Committee recommendations. There is currently a study looking at all of the challenges, I guess, with real life implementation of these algorithms, how it interacts with the technology that we use in the screening program. So how does it interact with the camera technology? How does it interact with the software that's used within the screening program to manage appointments and to record the grade and to communicate that back with the GPs, etc.? So there are a lot of challenges with introducing algorithms, and it's not going to be a single algorithm, which has the benefits of competition, but which has the complexities of making sure that different softwares or different algorithms will speak with each other and with all of the other elements of the NHS.
How close are we to seeing the use of AI in screening clinics like the one we featured at the beginning of this episode?
There is a small live implementation project that will be taking place in Northeast London over the course of the next year. And the things that we learn from that project hopefully will then be able to be escalated throughout the rest of the NHS to inform, hopefully, implementation over the next few years.
Well, I think if AI can make the whole service more efficient so that clinicians can actually spend more time talking to patients and communicating effectively, that can only be a good thing. Cathy, thank you very much for that overview. I think there are exciting times ahead.
Thank you very much, Michelle. It's been really exciting talking to you about this subject.
Coming up, Saj Mahmood, a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, will explain what happens to patients who need further attention after their diabetic eye screening. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore topics that are relevant to eye care practitioners working across the varied sectors of optometry practice. And that's why we want to hear from you. If you've got any suggestions for a topic you'd like us to explore, email us. The address is podcast@dockets.info, or you can tweet us at Sound Optometry. I'm now joined by Sajad Mahmood, a consultant ophthalmologist at Optegra Eye Hospital in Manchester, and who is also the medical retina lead for Optegra. Thanks for joining me, Saj.
It's a pleasure.
So far today, we've spent some of the episode looking at screening for diabetic eye complications. How common is retinopathy?
In the UK, approximately 5 to 6% of the population is diabetic. About a third of that diabetic population has some degree of retinopathy. There is this concept of a rule of thirds, that a third have some retinopathy, a third of those have macular edema, and a third of those actually require treatment.
So in general, what are the main stages of diabetic retinopathy?
So the terminology via the screening service for retinopathy is R1-3. And this correlates with the more international classification. So R1 correlates with background or mild pre-proliferative retinopathy. R2 correlates with more moderate and severe non-proliferative retinopathy, and R3 would correlate with proliferative retinopathy. And the screening service divides that into R3A and R3S, R3A implying that it's active proliferative retinopathy, which is more urgent, and R3S is proliferative retinopathy that's been treated. Maculopathy, from the screening service classification point of view, either there's none or it's present, M0 or M1. But clinically, we are concerned when the maculopathy is visually significant, involving the foveal centre. And these days, we are concerned based on the OCT thickness at the foveal centre. And that is what guides our treatment based on current NICE guidance.
Typically, what is the threshold for referral? What stage of retinopathy would you start to receive referrals?
Yes, so from a screening point of view, anything R2 and above, from a retinopathy point of view, would be an indication for referral. Although things might not be necessarily clinically significant, patients would be referred on, as they are R2 and above. There will be some evolution on this. What is rolling out is less frequent screenings, a 2-yearly screening in the low-risk categories. And there has been approval to start to incorporate OCT scanning as part of the screening service, but that's unlikely to happen until 2024 at the earliest.
So, Saj, you've mentioned R2 and M1. How likely is it that someone might have maculopathy but not have R2? You know, maybe they've only got R1 or maybe not even R1.
It's hard to put a figure on that, but all I would say, it's very common.
It's very common.
It's very because the diabetic screening images will only give you two views, one centered on the optic disc and one centered on the macula as the standard screening views. And that excludes a large proportion of the retina. So it's quite common that you may only see changes at the macula.
Yes. I'm just thinking with OCT coming into play later on in the future, we might start to see more maculopathy when we wouldn't necessarily have picked that up before.
Well, I would say if the maculopathy is clinically significant, then almost certainly they have got retinopathy. It's more the situations where you get the subtle, milder signs of maculopathy, which are not clinically significant, does not need treatment. And usually with those patients, they are relatively mild in terms of retinopathy as well.
So with the advent of OCT, do you think there will be a change to the M scale? Because we'll be looking at the macula in more detail.
Well, that's not been finalised. It's likely there will be a category of M1 that's referable and clinically significant. And that'll be based on the treatment guidance that we have in relation to the interventions that we currently use, the intravitreal anti-VEGF therapy.
So that leads me really nicely onto the next question that I was going to ask you, which was, you know, what are the treatments that are available for patients who are deemed to need treatment in the hospital eye service?
We still treat proliferative retinopathy with the laser. And to control the proliferative process, we do panretinal photocoagulation. And that is still the case. What has evolved over the years is more of a tendency to do modern multi-spot lasers, which are better at getting good coverage of the retina without causing as much collateral damage and without causing excessive amounts of scarring and effects on the visual field, although all these things can occur over the long term, not just due to the laser, but due to ischemia.
So that's the treatment for peripheral retinopathy. What's the criteria and the treatment for maculopathy?
The NICE guidance for anti-VEGF therapy, whichever drug we use, is that the central retinal thickness is 400 micrometers or higher. And in most departments, that tends to be the criteria that we use. Now, when the central retinal thickness is over 300, that's when there's some evidence that intervention would be beneficial. But in terms of cost effectiveness and national approval, again, the threshold has been set at 400.
So, Sarge, when anti-VEGF therapies aren't very effective or have limited effectivity, what are the alternatives available?
So the first-line treatment tends to be the anti-vascular endothelial growth factor injections. Moving on from that, if there's insufficient effect from these, we have the option of intravitreal steroid treatment. So the main treatments are intravitreal Ozurdex, dexamethasone, which is a slow-release delivery of dexamethasone. Typically, the implant lasts about 6 months and the substance is biodegradable. Another steroid is called Iluvien, fluocinolone. This tends to be the last resort, but it does have a long-lasting effect. The effect can last 2 to 3 years, but this tends to be reserved for patients who fail on all other therapies. We still use laser, interestingly, for diabetic macular edema, but not as a first line.
You mentioned that the steroid injections are a last resort. Is that because of the risk of using intravitreal steroids with intraocular pressure and controlling that if a patient does have a steroid response?
Yeah. So I said fluocinolone was the last in the line of treatments. That's got the highest potential risk of pressure problems and glaucoma. Ozurdex is more frequently used. And yes, a proportion of patients will get raised pressure as a side effect of it. It is a steroid. But that tends to be more manageable. And where it happens, it tends to be manageable with topical drops. So we don't shy away from using a steroid. But that's because the anti-VEGF treatments are quite successful in the great majority of patients.
Can I just ask you, if someone is being screened annually, but let's say in between screening, they report to their optometrist for an extra point because their vision's dropped and the optometrist finds evidence of some maculopathy, is there any kind of threshold for vision that they need to sort of be thinking about before they refer into a macular service?
This is where there is a discrepancy nationally, interestingly. In England, Wales and Northern Ireland, we follow NICE guidance, which gives no vision cutoff criteria. It simply says that we may treat patients when the central retinal thickness is 400 micrometers or more. And I think that makes sense, though, because even if the vision is good at that point, if the retina is thickened to that degree, then there is a high risk of that degrading the vision over time. Now, in Scotland, the rules are different. In Scotland, the 400 micrometers threshold is not applied in the same way. It is more about vision reduction. And the threshold is set at 6.9 or worse. The other thing to bear in mind, though, there has been some recent study data looking at whether early intervention is essential. There's some evidence that actually you can wait. So yes, in short, if there's vision reduction, it's more important and more urgent to refer, and it's more likely that we would treat. But if you suspect that there is macular edema and it's involving the foveal center, even if the vision's good, you're still obliged to refer, but it can be more routine.
So quite often in practice, we do see patients that are undergoing active treatment for their diabetic retinopathy. Is there anything that community optometrists can do to help these patients to make sure that they maximise the benefits of their treatment?
Yes, I don't think the hospital sector, because of how busy these clinics are and the throughput of patients coming through for their intravitreal injections and the volume of patients that are having monitoring, I don't think there's time to discuss the non-medical aspects. So I think reminding patients that ultimately, regardless of what's going on in terms of hospital treatment, patients can help themselves by improving systemic control and liaising with their GP practice to get advice on optimising their risk factors.
I think that's a really good reminder, actually, to have a more holistic approach, because we always assume that actually that's not directly our responsibility, so maybe someone else is going to cover it. Yeah. But also GP practices are overwhelmed as well. So if we all realise that the patients need that extra little bit of information, then between all of us, we should be able to help the patient more effectively.
I agree, certainly, yeah.
Saad, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're welcome, thank you.
That's all from us. If you head to docit.info and search for Saad Optometry, you can find additional reading materials and resources for this episode. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice. We'll be taking a month off for summer, but we'll have a brand new episode for you in September. Until then, why not check out our previous episodes? Or if you've exhausted all of them, remind your colleagues to listen. And make sure you subscribe to the series on your podcast app so you don't miss out on our next episode. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.